Life in the Persian Empire. The historian, in the words of one of the great scholars of Persian history, Pierre Briand, doesn't choose his sources. This is especially true in the case of Persian history. In writing the history of Persia, we're frequently reliant on Greek accounts that lay a heavy emphasis on negative characteristics, the decadence of the Persian court, the effeminacy of Persian kings, and the cruel punishments he meted out, sometimes whimsically, to those who crossed him. How are we to respond? We can just reject these accounts as fundamentally unsound and abandon the inquiry altogether. Or we can try to perform a kind of alchemy on the Greek sources, somehow dissolving the negative stereotypes of Greek accounts, but leaving their historical value intact. In the words of Pierre Briand again, we can distinguish the kernel or the nugget of genuine Persian fact from the Greek sources' interpretative coating. This is easier said than done, though. In many cases, Greek stories can plausibly be explained in terms of a Near Eastern context that's been misunderstood, knowingly or not. So, for example, the notorious episode in the Persian Wars, in which the Persian king Xerxes whips the water of the Hellespont, the channel of water between Asia and Europe, as a punishment for its destruction of a Persian pontoon bridge, should be seen not as a sign of the king's violent excesses, but as an expression of his religious beliefs. A similar approach has been taken to stories of the Persians' alleged extravagance when it comes to food. Xenophon characterises the Persian court as in a constant search for new delicacies to titillate the tired king's palate. The final section of his work, the Cyropaedia, sees the Persians eating and drinking so excessively from dawn to dusk that they need to be carried away from their banquets by their servants. This, however, misses the point. These banquets weren't just for feeding people. They were highly staged affairs, with guests seated in a precise order and elaborate ceremonies of gift-giving, designed to express the very hierarchical relationship between the king and his subject. Some Greek writers realised this political dimension to the Persians' feasts, and realised also that the king's worldwide search for delicacies was symbolic rather than the sign of extravagance. Though the Persians roasted whole oxen, horses, camels or donkeys in giant ovens, their meals, according to Herodotus, consisted of lots of small courses. Another writer, Heraclides, portrays the Persian banquet as in fact a relatively frugal affair, with leftovers being taken away in doggy bags or being given to the guards on duty. In these cases, then, we can make sense of Greek stories by using Near Eastern evidence as a foil, or by reading different Greek accounts against each other. In other areas of Persian society, the evidence of the clay tablets from Persepolis has also begun to give us a detailed picture which is largely independent of the versions of Greek writers. So, for example, in the area of Persian religion, previous generations of historians often assume that Darius's endlessly repeated claim to the support of the Zoroastrian god Ahura Mazda meant that he and his successors were in some simple sense Zoroastrian. The clay tablets reveal a much more complex religious world, though, more pluralistic, drawing on a number of earlier traditions, certainly nothing like the Zoroastrianism of later periods. The clay tablets also do away, once and for all, with any idea you might have that the Persian Empire was somehow an ephemeral thing, a loose confederation of peoples that was just waiting for Alexander to deliver the knockout blow. Its bureaucracy may have been unwieldy, but it reflects a highly developed, centralised administration.